Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Today, Thursday, marks the first full day in office for President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. It's also the first full day with a 50-50 U.S. Senate headed by Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. This has been a truly historic week in Washington, D.C., and it's hardly over yet. So here to give us his perspective on the transition of power and where we head from here is longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, none other than Ken Rudin. Hey, Ken.
Good morning, Randall. Not only a historic week, but an historic month. My goodness, think of what's going on since January 2nd, since the president made the phone calls to the Georgia election officials trying to overturn the election. This has been some month.
And I saw a post yesterday of three different pictures that represented each Wednesday in January, and they were all starkly different.
Two weeks ago was the mob ransacking the Capitol. Last Wednesday was the impeachment vote, and now of course this Wednesday was the inauguration. An incredible amount of time.
Yeah, the inauguration. So we saw a day of ceremonies unfold yesterday, like none prior. How do you feel the Biden administration handled the events, given, of course, the threat of potential violence layered with pandemic precautions and efforts to model good behavior on that front?
I think this was vintage Biden. Look, everybody knows about what happened the past 4 years. Everybody knows what's happened since the election. Everybody knows about what was happening when the 45th president was leaving the scene via helicopter and then flying to Florida. But the fact is, he, Joe Biden, now the 46th president, never mentioned Donald Trump's name. He did talk about unity. He said unity and uniting. I think he said those words maybe 15 times in the speech. And it was all about trying to look. I don't know how anybody could put the last 4 years behind us, but Joe Biden, represented the words and the tone that many Americans felt, that it's time to exhale. It's to look, our democracy bent, but it didn't break. But still, we have a lot of work to do.
And that tone was set throughout the day, like all of the different events from morning until the fireworks at night. There was messaging going on, and that's a pretty big feat to do that so consistently throughout the entire day.
That's absolutely true. And I think what's also very significant is that the feeling of moving ahead, moving forward, a new step is just basically what everybody was feeling. Now, I spoke to a lot of Trump people who were still upset about what happened. They just feel that it was stolen, and that Joe Biden is serving as an illegitimate president. But for many people, I saw so many people talking about tears and the fact that they're able to exhale. And I think, I feel this way about every inauguration. There's always a change. I've been watching, I've seen every inauguration since Kennedy in 1961, which is pretty incredible because I'm only 27 years old.
All right, do you do that?
The computers are amazing today. But I think the fact is that it's always represents a change, whether you're happy about it or not. When Carter took over after years of corruption, when Reagan took over after what was perceived as 4 years of weakness, there's always a new rejuvenation. This one felt different because, as I said, this one, there was just a threat to our way of life that sounds dramatic, but I think it's real. And I think that the tone set throughout the day, from Amanda Gorman's incredible reading to the low-key inaugural address by the president, to the events at night. Nobody's going to forget what happened the past 4 years. There's still more division coming up, especially if there's a Senate impeachment trial. But for one day, at least, for one brief shining moment, it seemed like it was a day of hope and rejuvenation.
Yeah, how about that 22-year-old poet from California?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I watched her and said, I didn't even think she was 22, but it was just remarkable, the poise, the words were, you know, we always talk about how important words are. It's not just TV with pictures. Words are very, very important, and she was just magnificent.
A lot is often made, Ken, of the caliber of stars that perform or show up. What's your take on that aspect?
Well, you know, something besides talking about J-Lo and Lady Gaga and Garth Brooks and people like that, I didn't listen to the radio, please forgive me, but I didn't listen to the radio because I wanted to see everything. But yes, there were no, you know, Sean Spicer, you're right. There were not so many people at the inauguration waiting on the ellipse and watching what was happening. But it felt the same. It felt the same amount of hope, the same amount of hoping for rejuvenation, the same kind of hope for unity. It felt good. It felt, I mean, you know, seeing that, look, it was different. Everybody wore a mask. There were elbow bumps. I mean, you know, look, you know, one has to make accommodations. But the fact is, 407,000 people have died in less than a year from this horrific virus that still, you know, people saying, well, even the president, the former president himself, kept saying it's turning the corner and we've turned the corner and it's going to go away very soon. Well, look, maybe the vaccines do work, but the fact is people are dying by the thousands every day. And that I think that's what hit me the most, the economic upheaval, the personal upheaval of losing loved ones, of losing your job, of losing your way in life, and people on the stage in Washington offering hope and promise. That contrast was pretty remarkable.
And the guy wiping down the podium between speakers has become a star in his own right.
And like, you know, there were more troops in D.C. than there are in Iraq and Afghanistan,
right,
which is a remarkable but understandable phenomena.
Ken, what do you make of the departure tradition where Vice President Harris and her husband walked Vice President Pence and his wife down the stairs to their car? That is typically a gesture done by the president to the outgoing president. But of course, the outgoing president had left hours earlier in this case.
Well, you know something, a lot of people were crediting Mike Pence for doing what he did, and he did the right thing. I'm not going to talk about what he's done for the past 4 years, but look, there are ceremonies and there are duties and there's a way to handle defeat and magnanimous actions. I thought the Mike Pence's appearance yesterday, the fact that he had the conversation with the incoming administration, I thought that was good. And it reminds us that, look, as I said, there's a Senate trial coming up. The Republican Party is still split on what the future looks like. Is it Trumpian? Is it Mitch McConnell hinting of working together? Or is it Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz saying the battle and the resistance will continue? But for at least, again, for that one day, I just liked that vision of continuation and a peaceful transfer of power.
Yeah, President Biden calling for unity. You mentioned this honeymoon period. When do you see the gloves coming off? Today?
Well, you know something, look, everybody talks about honeymoon period. We don't have time for a honeymoon period. We don't. There's so much. Again, the fact is, there is so much. And look, from the get-go, I mean, I don't think any president in history has signed as many executive orders as Joe Biden did yesterday. And a lot of it is to overturn what Donald Trump has done. And of course, Donald Trump spent his 4 years trying to overturn what Barack Obama has done. But I don't know if this is getting back to normal, but honeymoon, look, you know, once this hits the Senate, once the trial hits the Senate, you're going to see a lot of the old anguish and the old retribution and finger pointing that we've seen in the past 4 years. I think it'll resume. So again, let's savor what January 20th was about. Let's savor, I mean, the thought of not only a woman and not only a black, but a black woman becoming vice president in this era of chaos it lets us know that things can happen. Things can happen for the better. Things can change in a way that is so desperately needed. And You know, again, the yelling and the screaming and the point of orders and all that stuff is going to be coming quite soon. But my goodness, I woke up and went to sleep on January 20th feeling better than I have in a long time. And again, it's not because I'm a Democrat, or it's not because I voted for Joe Biden. That has nothing to do with anything. It's the civility and the decency and the integrity that I desperately missed the past 4 years. And I feel in Joe Biden and Kamala Harris that can return.
You mentioned this return to normalcy. I want to ask you about yesterday's first press briefing with the Biden administration. Jen Psaki, who is a seasoned pro at this, she used to work in communications for the Obama administration and the State Department. And she said this to the assembled press corps in the White House. Take a listen.
I have deep respect for the role of a free and independent press in our democracy and for the role all of you play. As I noted earlier, there will be moments when we disagree, and there will certainly be days where we disagree for extensive parts of the briefing, even perhaps, but we have a common goal, which is sharing accurate information with the American people. If the president were standing here with me today, he would say he works for the American people. I work for him, so I also work for the American people. But his objective and his commitment is to bring transparency and truth back to government, to share the truth even when it's hard to hear. That's something that I hope to deliver on in this role as well.
Across the board, the different White House press corps reporters that I heard from all said the same thing, that they were just stunned. Like, we haven't heard this in 4 years.
The sad part is they were stunned, because this should be the new normal. But hopefully this will become the new normal. I thought if Jen Psaki was going to do anything funny, she could have said, by the way, this was the biggest crowd in the history of inaugurations. But she didn't do that. But I was stunned also by, not stunned, but I was just relieved watching how it was normal that she would ask questions. The questions were with respect. The answers were with respect. And as Jen said, that, look, you know, we may not always agree. We may not see the same interpretation of what the news is, but we will always be honest with you. And, you know, a lot of presidents have said that. Jimmy Carter promised when he came into office in 1977, I will never lie to you. And of course, he may not have been the most successful president. And Joe Biden may not be able to create miracles either. But again, just like with Amanda Gorman, just like with the whole ceremony, watching Jen Psaki talk to the press, it felt like, is it only been 4 years since I felt this way? And again, we'll see battles between the administration and the press. Everybody forgets, or people seem to forget, that Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, they had very rocky relationships with the media, and so perhaps deservedly so, but it wasn't the enemy of the people ugliness that we've seen the 4 years. So another good thing that happened yesterday.
Longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Always a treat to speak with you, Ken Rudin.
Randall, thank you so much for having me. There is still hope in this country. I believe in it very strongly.
It's nice to hear. Thank you, Ken. Up next, we're discussing the future of the nation's two main political parties, with a focus on what's working, what's not, and whether the GOP can withstand the fracture caused by the former president. What are your thoughts? Shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and today we're reflecting a bit on this historic week and really month, as Ken Rudin just pointed out, in Washington, as well as considering what's next. As the Democrats take control in the nation's capital, some members of the GOP are left to wonder what's to become of their party in the wake of former President Trump. Co-founder of the Lincoln Project and Republican strategist Mike Madrid joins us now to give us his perspective on where the Republican Party now stands. And Mike, I've been curious about your thoughts over the past few weeks, and it's nice to have you on the show to hear them.
Randall, thanks for having me. Appreciate that.
So you do have limited time this morning, so I'm going to ask you a few questions before we bring in the other political analysts. And I want to start with an article in the New York Times today that says there are now three categories of Republicans following the Trump administration. One is the Never Trumpers, which you would be among, correct?
That's right.
It says there are some Republicans whose names were once synonymous with the party's hard right, who are now ridiculed as spineless and soft by faithful followers of the former president because they did not support his efforts to push state legislatures and Congress to back up false election claims. Would you say that's true as well?
I think that's correct as well.
And then thirdly, there are those Trump loyalists. So where does such a fractured party go today?
Well, the prognosis for the future of the party is not good. Nationally, I think it's going to look very similar to what we saw 20 years ago here in California, where the Republican Party will increasingly become a regionalized nominal force in elective politics. As we've shared before, Randall, in previous conversations, the overwhelming sentiment amongst the average Republican voter is largely about white grievance politics. Now, there are some exceptions to that, but they are very few and far removed. And the reason why that's important is you have to understand that the Republican Party has moved away from classical conservatism and towards a more nationalist, white nationalist element, not atypical of what you see in European countries. And so as this continues to devolve, this Republican devolution continues, you will continually see a party that is increasingly, and I don't want to say it's fractured, because the overwhelming sentiment amongst the average Republican voter is still with Donald Trump, but there's simply a fleeing, especially with college-educated voters. Those that are more educated are really leaving the Republican Party very quickly. And so I don't think the Republican Party will split or fracture. It will just continue to devolve into a smaller, monolithic, more marginalized party of white grievance, largely.
Where do those who are fleeing go?
Well, like me, they're politically homeless at the moment. And the truth of the matter is, I think it's probably better than not. One of the things that we have not discussed much on the national stage because of the dominance of the Trump element is the fracturing that is happening within the Democratic Party. And I think that's important because what we're witnessing is a social phenomenon. A lot of political people like to think it's a win or lose game. You either win if you're red or blue, or Republicans or Democrats, conservatives, progressives. The truth is that's not how the average voter is witnessing this lobbying between the two parties. We're witnessing a dramatic rise in populism on both the right and the left, and the typical ideological structures of both parties is being overturned. And so we're about to enter a very, very volatile time in American politics that will probably last us for a couple of decades, for a couple of dynamics, a couple of reasons, but both parties are really losing their cachet amongst voters. And we're seeing more and more voters more aligned with what they're voting against as opposed to what they're voting for.
More, and certainly more people registering as no party preference.
Yeah. And again, that's important, too. It's one of the main indicators. And it's not necessarily that we know that. Well, let me rephrase it this way. We know that demographically, those that unaffiliate with the parties are still largely voting as partisan voters. These are not undecided. There's not like people are trying to figure out where they stand on the issues. They're very clear, they're very certain, but they are simply rejecting the orthodoxy and the tribalism that both parties represent. I think in very short order, like 6 to 8 years, we will probably not have the two-party system structured anywhere near the way that it is today.
Mm-hmm. Where's the split in the Democratic Party as you see it? Is it among the more liberal Democrats, the Bernie Sanders and the members of the squad, versus the more centrists like President Joe Biden?
Yeah, in a very elementary way, that's probably the best way to frame it. But again, I think Bernie Sanders represents a sort of populism that is emergent, not unlike what Donald Trump presented as a threat to the establishment of the Republican Party. Now, it's clearly not driven by the same racism and xenophobia that was fueling and white grievance that was fueling Trumpism, but there is a very strong rejection against the standard norms and institutions, and frankly, the basic monetary system of the United States that the left is, and it's not fringe, by the way. In the Democratic Party, one of the most profound things during the primary was voters overwhelmingly sided with Bernie Sanders over Joe Biden. Joe Biden was able to secure the nomination in the Democratic primary for one main reason, and that is because he was viewed as the most likely to be able to beat Donald Trump, which goes to my earlier point, and that is people are voting against Donald Trump more than they were voting for Joe Biden. And that's a really important distinction to understand with the topic that you're challenging today and the questions that you're asking. That is, there was a clear rejection of both extreme elements in the 2020 elections. People were literally going to the ballot and saying, I'm rejecting the extremism of Donald Trump, and down ticket, I'm rejecting the extremism in Congress of the Democrats who have been really consumed by the left base of their party. And that's not atypical. This is really typical of a 30-year trend that we've seen since at least the mid-1990s that demonstrates that voters are voting for divided government. They're taking a mandate away from both parties, and they're slipping away rather dramatically away from the two-party system. They're simply locked into this system that we have created over the past 150 years that demands that they choose between a red candidate or a blue candidate. And they're really not satisfied with either decisions, choices at this moment in time.
Is there a chance, given the tone set yesterday during the inauguration, now that the messaging coming out of the White House will be very different, that the GOP factions, and for that matter, the Democrat factions, can come together? I mean, at least on the side of the GOP, nothing brings people closer together than a common enemy, right?
Yeah, and that's really reflective of both parties. That's absolutely fair. Look, if the question is, do I think that there's a chance for greater bipartisan compromise and working on major pieces of legislation, my answer is yes. And it's really more of a practical reason than an ideological reason. I think that it's not going to take too many votes on it on the Republican side to move over and vote with the majority party, because it's the slimmest majority in about 70 or 80 years. I mean, mm-hmm. We're talking a razor-thin majority in the Senate and not much bigger in the House. And so both leaders, I think, are going to be looking more towards getting something accomplished because the challenges before us are so significant, rather than, you know, just digging in and being kind of the party of no, which has traditionally been the Republican Party's position for the past couple of decades. Having said that, there is an insurrectionist element within the Republican Party. That is undeniable. There are traitors to the Constitution and to our republic who are holding office in the federal government. There must be a reckoning for that. There must be some sort of adjudication that says this cannot stand. And we make a very, very big, dangerous decision to move forward without holding these insurrectionists accountable. That was the very big mistake we made after the Civil War, and it lasted us 150 years because we never reconciled these differences.
Specifically, the Lincoln Project, your organization, is shifting its focus to Senators Ted Cruz of Texas and Josh Hawley of Missouri and California Congressman House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, right?
The Lincoln Project is actually going to be moving in a number of different directions. Don't know how long the affiliation directly will be there, because after in the post-Trump era, the threats to democracy, I think, are on numerous different fronts. But having said that, yes, it is fair to say that at the moment, those three who led and fomented insurrection need to be held to account. There will be more, of course. And as we have said, and look, We were criticized very heavily as a Lincoln Project because people said we were being hyperbolic, we were exaggerating the potentiality of violence, the potentiality of revolution, the potentiality of the threat to our Constitution. A lot of Republicans would roll their eyes and simply dismiss it. Look, I don't like to be vindicated in this way because it's been so damaging to my country, but there is no exaggeration when I say that there is a wide swath of the Republican Party that holds revolutionary sentiment, seditionist sentiment, anti-constitutional sentiment. The Republican Party stands today as the single largest existential threat to democracy in the United States of America. And if we do not smash this rebellion, we will live to regret it over the next few decades as it continues to gather strength and have oxygen breathed into it.
I know you have to go. I kept you a minute longer than we had said. Co-founder of the Lincoln Project and Republican strategist Mike Madrid, thank you so much for your thoughts on this morning.
Randall, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Joining us now are a few familiar names to Insight. We call on them often when we want to hear their perspective from a partisan angle. Welcome back to Robin Swanson. Robin is a Democratic strategist based here in Sacramento. Nice to see you, Robin.
Good morning.
Also joining us, chair of the Republican Party of San Joaquin County, Reverend Dwight Williams. Welcome back, Reverend. Nice to see you as well.
Nice to see you too.
So I really have to start with you, Reverend, after what Mike Madrid just said there, that the Republican Party is the single most existential threat to our democracy. What are your thoughts on that statement?
I absolutely reject that statement. I respect Mike's opinion, but the Republican Party is not the greatest threat to democracy in the United States. The Republican Party has fought to help preserve a robust debate off within our country. Surprised he didn't mention anything like other groups on the left, like Antifa and other type of related groups on the left. So to say that basically 75 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump are basically the threat to the United States is a statement that I categorically reject.
I think he might have been more focused on the leaders who have not condemned the actions saw at the Capitol 2 weeks ago yesterday, specifically Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, Kevin McCarthy in California, who did speak out against it at the Capitol, but still voted against accepting the election's results. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, election results many times throughout our history has been contested. That is not unusual. So the events that took place on the Capitol and the violence that took place there should be condemned, just like all the violence that took place throughout the summer of last year. Violence, whether it's on the left or on the right, should be condemned. So that's not really the issue. The issue was in a very highly polarized presidential election. You had allegations and concerns that were raised, and there are mechanisms in place that allow individuals to be able to adjudicate those type of remedies and to try to bring and address those issues. Can tempers get flared up a little bit on the high side? Sure, but the process played out at the end of the day. We had a transfer of power, and you live to fight another day.
I do want to go back to this fracture in the Republican Party. A New York Times article that I referenced just a moment ago with Mike said that it's basically there are three factions. One is the Never Trumpers, which Mike is a part of. Then the second one is a group of Republicans who are now being lashed out at because they did not back the president's claims of an unfair election. And then third would be the Trump supporters. Which one of those factions would you put yourself in today?
Well, I'm definitely was a supporter of President Trump, no question about that. I think the Never Trumper side was a relatively small side of it, so I really don't see them as a significant role. They played a minor role, at least within the party, but President Trump still has a tremendous amount of support within the party. Again, looking beyond the personality and looking just at the issues, those issues will still remain active parts of conversation and discussion and advancement within America over the next 2 to 4 years.
Democratic strategist Robin Swanson, I want to bring you in, of course. You heard Mike Madrid mention that there is a fracture in the Democratic Party as well. What are your thoughts regarding that statement?
It doesn't feel very fractured yesterday. I have all the respect in the world for what Mike Madrid and the Lincoln Project was able to do. It was really very groundbreaking what they were able to do. But his read of the numbers are just wrong. I mean, Democrats, especially, you look at California, Democrats are 46%, 46.3%, I think, of registered voters. The Republican Party is 24%. You look nationally, we picked up 2 United States Senate seats in the state of Georgia. We have a majority in both the House and the Senate. And while our president was reaching out to not only people who voted for him, but those who voted for Donald Trump, he really, in the first 24 hours of his presidency, has done what are really sort of core value democratic executive orders. So whether that's on climate change, the Muslim ban, taking down or stopping building the border wall. So I think you're seeing some reconciliation, but I don't see fractures at all right now.
Robin, what do you make of the seats that were lost in California, though, of all states, to end up this past election with fewer seats than it started?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we are still an overwhelming majority, 2/3 majority blue state. So I do think, you know, that there are different kinds of Democrats in California, and that's okay. There are Central Valley Democrats that run more conservative than a Bay Area Democrat. But that's why Democrats have been a big tent party in the state of California, is because you're able to define what that means.
Reverend Williams, I want to ask you about the tone set yesterday at the inauguration and how you feel about that as someone from the other party. Do you feel that the nation is going in the right direction? Are you optimistic about what you might see in a Biden presidency regarding, you know, reaching across the aisle?
I am guardedly optimistic. I'm sort of like what Ronald Reagan used to say in one of his negotiations with the Soviets, trust but verify. The tone yesterday that President Biden stated, I was encouraged by. That was on yesterday. But let's see how we are in a week, in a month, 3 months from now, after the first 100 days, if you will, which is a benchmark in a new president's term. Look, Joe Biden, by nature, is a person who knows how to work with both sides of the aisle. I just hope that the factions within the party will allow him that flexibility to be able to do that the way vintage Joe Biden is. But he has powerful forces within the Democratic Party that's going to make it very challenging for him indeed to maybe do some of the things that he may ideally want to do. Mm.
Robin, regarding the impeachment trial that will take place in the Senate, I believe starting next week, and Biden has already taken executive actions to undo several of former President Trump's policies. Do you see this as quickly moving away from this moment that we had yesterday?
I don't. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot that happens. There are a lot of members of Congress, and they're able to walk and chew gum at the same time. So we can hold insurrectionists accountable while governing and creating new policies in this country. And I do think that the number one unifier, the number one thing that this president can do that will unify our country, Democrats, Republicans, independents, declined states, you name it, is to address the pandemic. The one thing that they were really good about pointing out was that 400,000 souls have been lost to this pandemic in the United States of America. And I think that is a completely nonpartisan issue. We all want to save our grandparents and elderly and sick and neighbors and moms and dad. I mean, all of that is the relatable common thread that I think this president will find. And if he's able to start on that note, I think that he's going to have nowhere to go but up.
Reverend, I saw you nodding during that. Would you say that that's true, that that would be a common thread we can all get behind?
Yes, I would agree with that. And I would hope also one thing that could help be a bridge to some of the issues of division is if we could set aside, if you will, any talk about impeaching a former president. First of all, I don't even know if that's legally possible to do. There's debate among some constitutional experts on that. And frankly, even if we were to address some of the cancel culture sentiment that's coming off in some parts of society, which is trying to cancel, there's some concerns about blacklisting of certain supporters. I don't think that will be a good way to bring unity. I think President Biden could speak to a lot of those issues and tell everybody to kind of tone down. Again, his speech yesterday, many elements of it that I did appreciate, but he can go further by dealing with some of those specifics and just try to focus on the issues where we can try to work together. There will be disagreement and differences of opinion. Unity doesn't mean that we all have to agree on everything. It just means that we need to be more civil in our disagreement to try to work through the processes to try to find common ground for all of the American people.
That's what we try to do here with both of you as well. Reverend, do you believe that the president incited the violence that we saw 2 weeks ago?
I would have used different language myself. There's still some discussions as far as they pertain to some of the people that were involved in that. But again, emotions are running high. Again, I go back to what I said. Violence is wrong, whether all the violence that took place, even some of the stuff that's going on in Portland recently as last evening and across the country, violence is wrong regardless, whether it's on the left or on the right. Again, I hope and I pray that we can be able to address our issues in a more civil way. If me and Robin Swanson, for example, were up in Washington, we could solve a lot of the problems that we have, because Robin and I like each other personally, and I think we could solve them. But that's a little joke. Hi, Robin, by the way.
Amen to that, Reverend.
I love to hear that between the two of you. Let's talk. We only have a couple of minutes here. Let's talk a little bit about diversity. Just on the surface, you can see a significant difference between the Biden and Trump administrations. Dwight, as an African-American, are you pleased with the change you are seeing? And Robin, with what more could Biden do to make his administration look more like America? And I'll start with you, Reverend.
Well, I'm happy to see any diversity, not only of representation, but also of tremendous expertise in a range, not just filling a box for the sake of a color box or a ethnic box, but also to be able to be groundbreaking in their expertise. I mean, you had some of those improvements even within the Trump administration as well. Of a greater African-American participation within party leadership, national, et cetera, all the way down to local level, look like myself. So I'm glad to see in a diverse country like ours, to see people have opportunities of leadership in both major political parties and within the governmental structure as well. I'm very encouraged. Mm-hmm.
And Robin, your thoughts on what we can do more?
Yeah, I mean, I turned to yesterday and the diversity that we saw yesterday, from J-Lo speaking a little bit of Spanish to, our vice president representing what she does from the African-American community and from the Asian-American community. I mean, she just, I think, represents all of it. But we were able to see that. And I think when people see it, they can imagine it. And it just, that becomes what is normal. And so I think that's a really important piece of it. And I think the one piece I would like to see a little bit more of is maybe some younger voices and younger that people represented. I heard an interesting statistic yesterday that the average American is 38 years old, which was surprising to me. And I do think that our administration and the folks in the administration need to represent young people and the way that they look and feel. Though I know that he's referred to as an elder statesman at what, 78 years old, I think Joe Biden is. But I think of Jerry Brown and how he governed California, and part of me just embraces that, because at a certain age, he's not jockeying for position. He's not worried about what everyone is saying about him. And I think if President Biden can take on some Jerry Brown persona as he governed California, and that he can bring people together without worrying so much about what people are thinking or saying, but just wants to do the right thing, I think, again, that's going to be the victory for our country.
Democratic strategist Robin Swanson, thank you so much for your thoughts on this.
Thank you.
Also, head of the San Joaquin County Republican Party, Dwight Williams, always a pleasure to see you as well. Thank you, sir.
It's always great to see you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Robin.
And still ahead, the significance of diversity in American politics this year will continue down that thread, including President Biden's cabinet and Kamala Harris's history-making day after being sworn in as vice president. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We are back in just a moment.
Yeah. Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Kamala Harris was sworn in as vice president yesterday, shattering many barriers, not only as the first woman to hold a nationally elected office, but as the first black woman and first Asian American to reach such political heights. Here's the moment Vice President Harris was sworn into history.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely.
That I take this obligation freely.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
Without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
That I will well and faithfully discharge.
The duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
The duties of the office upon which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
All right.
And there you have it. The justice did have the emphasis on the wrong syllable there. The correct pronunciation is Kamala. The vice president has said herself, just combine the punctuation mark comma with la and you got Kamala. So joining us now to talk about the significance and what it means going forward is Anna Sampaio. She's a professor of ethnic studies and political science and chair of the ethnic studies department at Santa Clara University in the Bay Area, of course, South Bay. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's great to join you.
Yeah. So, Professor, your first reaction after watching Kamala Harris make history as she was sworn into office?
It was an extraordinary day. It was an extraordinary moment, not least of all because Kamala Harris had risen to this opportunity that no other woman of color had ever reached, and many of us believed we would never see in our lifetimes, but that she was also sworn in by a Latina on the Supreme Court. So you had two women of color who were in this incredibly prominent role and who were prepared to lead the country in sort of new and important ways. So I cried all day. I cried basically all day, and I had my young daughter next to me, and you know, she really was, she herself was impressed by the importance and the weight of the moment. Mm.
So thinking about issues of racial and gender diversity or racial and gender justice, how does yesterday's inauguration and the proposed cabinet positions play into the significance of all this moving forward?
Well, you know, one of the things people like to say is personnel is policy. And so on the one hand, you've got symbolic importance, right? You've got a signal to people that this is a country to which they belong, that they can see themselves reflected in the highest institutions, that the country's values reflect their values and experiences. But the other issue is that these people also reflect very real experiences, experiences with inequality, experiences with discrimination, experiences with obstacles, and they offer perspectives based and drawn from those positions that can in many ways inform then policy, inform significant policy changes, or even serve to advance important policy changes for racial justice. So when we talk about the need to diversify these offices, it's not just a symbolic representation, albeit there is value in that in and of itself. Mm. It's also for the purposes of advancing perspectives and policies that otherwise are not necessarily included in those institutions.
Mm-hmm. So what's next? I guess that's always the key question, right? I mean, yesterday was the inauguration. Now today's the first full day. What kinds of obstacles or opportunities can we expect in the days, weeks, months, years to come?
Well, I mean, yesterday was dizzying, not just because of the inauguration events, but for the blizzard of executive orders that came from that administration that was really prepared to hit the ground running. So the folks that have been nominated and the folks who have been doing this work behind the scenes aren't just representing on these issues. These are also people with a good degree of political experience. These are people who have already cut their teeth in other policy venues in either state governments or regional associations or even community organizing. So they were prepared to hit the ground running. So there was over, you know, 15 executive actions that were signed yesterday, advancing all kinds of changes in immigration reform and racial injustice, gender justice. And so part of what's going to happen today is we're going to continue to see some of these actions unfold. Just last night, we saw another executive action be signed directing changes on immigration enforcement, which was hugely important. And so part of the work is going to be continue to enroll and to unfold those executive actions, but also then, of course, moving on legislative changes. And that, I think, is going to be the big hill to climb, obviously. There's some things like immigration reform and particularly pathway to citizenship that are absolutely going to require congressional action, and that is going to be a big hill to climb. So putting those folks' expertise to work, especially folks in like the DPC, to advance those kinds of changes, it's going to be really important.
You foresee this Biden administration differing from the Obama administration when it comes to immigration, because sometimes people forget, but there was a lot of arrests and those sorts of things under the Obama administration. It wasn't just under the Trump administration.
Absolutely. In fact, there was a very aggressive ramp up in enforcement and detentions and deportations, to the point that, you know, he got the nickname Deporter in Chief by the end of his first term. And, you know, he had made some pretty strategic miscalculations over how much he could give to the Republican Party and conservatives in order to buy their support. The Biden administration is not making those same mistakes, at least not from the get-go. We saw yesterday a number of executive orders, and as I said, particularly on this issue of enforcement, of shifting back to some of the policy priorities for enforcement. For instance, under the Trump administration, basically all undocumented persons became targets for apprehension, detention, and deportations. Everyone was a suspect. Everyone was perceived as a threat to the country. And one of the things that Biden did yesterday was to reverse that and to really direct ICE to not only review and scrutinize its practices, but really target people who are perceived to be have committed aggravated felonies, who are national security or homeland security threats, to really recalibrate where we're going to go with enforcement and to align it with these national priorities for inclusion. And so we are already seeing from the get-go a very different stance from where Obama was at the beginning of his administration.
Doctor, how about the significance of Alex Padilla taking a U.S. Senate seat, the first Latino from California to do that? I don't know if you got a chance. It sounds like you were watching a lot of what was going on yesterday. I don't know if you got a chance to see Kamala Harris in the Senate during that. She was even asked if it was weird to mention her own, resignation. But I'm wondering about the significance of Alex Padilla in that role.
It was one of my favorite moments of the day, watching her preside over not only the senators from the state of Georgia coming in, but obviously Alex Padilla being the first Latino from the state of California to serve in the U.S. Senate. That was an extraordinary moment. It's particularly for California, because we have one of the largest populations of Latinos. You know, we're reaching 40% plus. And have never had a Latino in that position. And because the Democratic Party is really going to have to do a lot of work in order to advance Latino interests, not only because of the significance of the population, because they are the largest racial population, second largest racial population, but the largest racial minority population in the country. But also because there are a number of, again, policy issues that are central to this community that have not been served in the past by previous administrations, and Alex Padilla is well versed in them. So, you know, his, again, move into that position is both symbolically important. Number of Latinos celebrated that day. You know, the preponderance of Latinos come from families who are mixed. And so if you're not an immigrant, you're somebody in your family is. So we were all celebrating. But it's also because of the importance, again, for advancing significant legislative changes in this term.
Doctor, I should have asked you right off the top, Anna or Anna?
I respond to both. And as a good Latina, I have about five names. And so it's actually Ana Cristina, which is my first name, but right. I respond to both. Well, my mom would say Ana.
Okay, well, I'll follow your mom's lead because I'm sure she's wise. Yeah. Dr. Ana Sampaio, professor of ethnic studies and political science and chair of the ethnic studies department at Santa Clara University. We truly appreciate you taking time this morning to share your thoughts on such a historic time for the U.S.
Thank you so much.
And that is Insight for today. You can learn more about all of our guests, including the doctor there, at capradio.org/insight. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, and managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital team Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta, technical director Mark Jones, engineer Antonio Munez. I'm Randall White, and we'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.